This afternoon, it felt a bit like being 17 again, walking through college and the Oxford drizzle. It seems barely 10 minutes, actually, since this was my home, the centre of my world. Of course, it's not really 10 minutes at all. In fact, the first time I set foot in this room was literally half a lifetime ago. I realised to my absolute horror this week that my 5-year-old daughter is now closer to matriculation age than I am. Even so, it still feels like yesterday, and today has felt a bit like coming home. So thank you so much to St John's for giving me the opportunity to speak today, and to you all for coming. And also, because these memories are so fresh, it wasn't that difficult to hark back to the 17-year-old version of myself and think about some of the things that I wish I'd known then, and trying to work out what to do with the rest of my life, and which that is, in essence, what I'd like to talk to you about today. If not you, who? If not now, when? Let me start by explaining why I chose the title. It's an expression that's been around a long time. In my lifetime, it's been appropriated by all sorts of people, from President Reagan to the rock band Incubus. But it's been on my mind lately in particular, from the actress Emma Watson. She used it in a much admired speech at the UN last year on gender equality. Some of you may have seen it. She was talking about how she overcame her self-doubt around why anyone should listen to someone like her talk about a topic like that. And she said that she hoped that that sentiment might embolden others to speak out in support of the same cause. And that struck a chord with me for several reasons. The first relates to the milestone that we're celebrating this year, the 2,000 St John's women who've matriculated. I'd love to know actually what number I was on that list. Perhaps we could get hats, like the England cricket team. These women have been lucky. We've been lucky. We've benefited from one of the best educations on the planet. And in general, today, women have access to educational opportunities that their counterparts a century ago could only imagine. And yet, here we are in 2015, and people like Emma Watson are still having to stand up in the UN and make the case that women should be afforded the same rights as men. Now, that sounds to me like the most obvious truism in the world. But amazingly, to use just one of her stats, at the current rates of progress, it will take another 75 years for women to be paid the same as men to do the same work. Now, how can that be? So there's certainly been progress in our lifetimes, and we're right to recognise the pioneers of that change, including those very first St John's women, who, by my reckoning, were probably having their interviews to join here the very month I was born. But there's an awful lot of work to do. And there's another reason why this expression resonated with me in particular. I think it says something important about self-image and also about attitudes to risk. Now, my own perspectives on these have changed hugely over the years, but none never so more as during my 4 years at St John's. And given how significant an impact those changes had on my life since I left Oxford, I figured that today, in this place, with this group of people, that should be top of the list. So cast your mind back to 1996. There was girl power of a different sort. The Spice Girls were top of the charts. Charles and Diana got divorced. And there was a fairly forgettable Summer Olympics in Atlanta. And horrifyingly, some of the current St. John's freshers were being born. And here's me in my last year at school. My husband likes to think of this as my Kurt Cobain period. Personally, one of the things I'm most grateful to for St. John's is that the way the whole experience changed the way I thought about myself. Now, the 18-year-old me would definitely not have fancied talking in front of a group of people like yourselves. In fact, these days, while I can't claim any expertise, I can at least manage it without falling over. And that's largely because university made me a better and more confident version of myself. When I was younger, I always had a bit of a blushing problem. And I remember English lessons in particular. We used to have the study text that would go around the room and we'd all have to take a turn reading out loud. And I would just cower thinking about this book coming towards me. When it came to my turn, I could feel myself going pink, and that makes you pinker and pinker. You know, I was just so self-conscious. And I also felt a bit like that when I came to interview for Oxford. Like most of you here, I imagine, I vividly remember my Oxford interview experience. I arrived in a freezing North Quad to be grilled by my tutors. Thank you for joining today. The questions actually still bring me out in a cold sweat. You probably don't remember them. But Dr. Jacobs, you gave me a slide rule and asked me if I knew what it was, and then proceeded to grill me on the differences between analog and digital. And Dr. Sobey, you asked me to find the three roots of minus 8. And I found minus 2 quite quickly and then was just utterly flummoxed. But the other thing I really vividly remember about coming to interview here was the men in particular. They seemed so polished, so confident. And I can remember thinking that even if I lived to 100, I could never be like that. And I often think back now and wonder why that was. I was lucky enough to come from a very nice, very happy middle-class background. So whatever our fellow alumnus Mr. Larkin might think, I don't think I can really blame my parents. Perhaps my shyness was just a fluke of nature, the kind of random personality payout of the genetic lottery. But I also actually wonder whether it's something about the way society tells girls how to behave. For girls in particular, doing well generally means sticking to certain rules. It means knowing how to be good. And that usually translates in this context to being quiet, modest about one's achievements, and obedient. And it means politely putting up one's hand, waiting to be asked. You know, all very admirable character traits, but not necessarily ones that will pay dividends at Oxford interviews or later in the workplace. And this is something that's been in the news quite a lot lately, thanks to people like Sheryl Sandberg, the Facebook COO, whose book, Lean In, is all about women being more assertive in the workplace. Now, you've probably read about her Ban Bossy campaign, which is based upon the idea that assertiveness in boys is seen as a leadership quality and praised, but the same position in girls is disparaged as bossiness. And for me, this is something I've been thinking about a lot ever since I had a daughter of my own, and I certainly think there's something in it. You know, my daughter, she's 5 years old, and certainly without any encouragement from us, she loves princesses, fairies, pink things, including, in particular, this monstrosity. Meanwhile, my three-year-old boy, who presumably had more or less the same inputs, with added pink hand-me-down clothing, seems to prefer cars and trains and bikes and balls. Well, mostly. And it seems silly to worry about this sort of thing when they're so little. But at the same time, there was a study a few years back in the US which looked at almost 6,000 children's books published between 1900 and 2000. And it found that 57%, almost 60% of books published each year had central male characters, whereas the number was about half of that for female characters. And the authors of the report concluded, "The disproportionate numbers of males in central roles may encourage children to accept the invisibility of women and girls." And when you see stats like that, it's hard to escape the conclusion that there's a degree of social conditioning going on, that it starts from a very young age, and that it's powerful enough to resist most people's efforts to balance it out. Now, maybe you buy this, maybe you don't. But what's certainly true is that when I showed up in Oxford, I'd never really been the kind of confident extrovert type. And perhaps as a consequence of that, the idea of becoming an entrepreneur had never really occurred to me. You know, and perhaps it should have done. I come from a family of immigrants who have gone from a nomadic lifestyle, literally in yurts of Mongolia, to a new life in China, and then to America, and then to the UK in the space of two generations. So I should have had finely tuned risk instincts. And just in case that sounds like a lazy stereotype, I'm going to quote you some numbers. According to the Centre for Entrepreneurs, migrant entrepreneurs are the driving force behind 1 in 7 of the UK companies. Or to put it another way, entrepreneurial activity amongst migrant community here is nearly twice that of the UK population. But at 18, I knew what an entrepreneur looked like, and it definitely wasn't me. Entrepreneurs were charismatic, wheeler-dealer, smooth-talking salesmen, and they were almost always men. The Alan Sugars, the Richard Bransons of the world. And funnily enough, Charlie, the guy I went into business with, was very much of that type. And actually, my favourite story about Charlie was that in 2003, he went to watch the Rugby World Cup And if any of you are into rugby, you'll know this was the year that England finally got to the finals of the Rugby World Cup, and he went to see it in Australia. And there was a famous semi-final between England and France that Charlie was lucky enough to attend. And that night in the stadium, it was raining, really raining hard. And so Charlie, being Charlie, spots a man outside the stadium who's selling ponchos. And he's selling ponchos for $5 each. So he takes all the money that he's got on him and buys up this entire lot of ponchos from outside the stadium, stuffing them into his coat and wandering off inside of the stadium, where he begins reselling them for $10 each to the English and $20 to the French. So you kind of get a picture of the kind of guy he is. And I didn't see myself as that kind of person. You know, on the other hand, I was in Oxford at a time when the dot-com boom was just starting. And actually lots of different sorts of people were starting businesses. People like Martha, now Baroness Lane Fox, at Last Minute, who was just a few years previously ahead of me. And suddenly there were lots more positive role models around. Suddenly becoming an entrepreneur was actually the kind of career you could tell your grandma about. So that was all very inspiring. And in fact, there was a really very real sense of, if not now, when. It was so inspiring, in fact, that some friends and I decided to set up in our final year what we called Upstart Network, which was a business that involved creating networks and entrepreneurial connections in my final two terms. Sorry, Dr. Jacobs. In fact, our very first event was held here in the St. John's Auditorium, and we'd spent some time flyering colleges and putting up adverts in the hope that people might show up. And we had 600 people come to our first event. We started running them across a few different universities, and it was all really quite fun. But importantly, it made me realise that there are lots of different elements to being an entrepreneur. Being able to sell is really important, perhaps more important than anything else. But it's not enough on its own. So all told, the Oxford experience changes, I think, the way a lot of people think about themselves, and I was no exception. And suddenly, the idea of being an entrepreneur didn't seem so ridiculous anymore. If not me, then who? The other thing that Oxford changed for me was the way I thought about risk. In the spring of 2000, I found myself with a decision to make. I've been doing interviews for various corporate jobs, the kind of standard route out of university, I felt. But at the same time, there was this sort of nagging idea of doing something entrepreneurial. And on the one hand, I had a kind of conventional corporate gig, and on the other, this crazy startup idea. It was obviously a big decision. So I did what felt natural, at least to me, and I started asking people for advice. Some obvious people, like my mum. And surprisingly, for someone that cares so little about business that I still have to explain to her the difference between turnover and profit, she was all for the startup idea. And she grew up in the US, so perhaps it was some sort of residual American positivity. But actually, she gave to me what I call the golden seed, which is, you know, when you have a self-doubt, you just need somebody who says, I believe in you, and someone to give you that little germ of confidence that then you can then grow. And I also asked some rather less obvious people, in fact, like this guy, who was to be found one evening in the Petit Blanc in Oxford, a consulting company anxious to woo our degree course, had taken the entire year out for dinner at the Petit Blanc, which obviously is not the kind of place you get to go as a student. So there was I in a group of 40 men in the Petit Blanc, and there was Richard Branson across the room, sitting on his own and staring, at least I thought so, in my general direction. Remarkably, in a fairly out-of-character move, I decided it would be a good idea to beckon him over, perhaps emboldened by Accenture's liquid hospitality. But even more remarkably, Richard Branson got up and he came over, and I had the chance to talk to him that night, and I asked him about my decision and whether to take the corporate job or become an entrepreneur. And he gave me some really useful advice. Now, actually, the really interesting question here is that actually lots of people have an opportunity to make a risky decision or perhaps take the more travelled path. And what is it that normally holds people back from such a decision? Well, to me, it boils down to perhaps four areas. Trepidation, procrastination, destitution, and normalisation. And not because they just all end in shun. So let's start with trepidation. And I think there are two parts to this. The first is the fear of failure. Now, generally speaking, you don't get to be somewhere like St. John's by making loads of mistakes. So we're not used to failing, and we're not very good at it. I can still remember the crushing disappointment of failing my grade one piano, age 7. Still haven't quite got over it. And the second really is the fear of ignorance, so another reason to be feeling full of trepidation. And despite the manifest advantages of starting a business and being a St. John's graduate, we did have two minor stumbling blocks to overcome. We didn't know anything, and we didn't know anyone. Now, you'd think actually the first would be your biggest problem, but actually it's the second. Because if you can reach the right people, you can fill in the gaps in your own knowledge. So our first step was to shamelessly exploit our network. So we contacted everyone we knew. Everyone we kind of knew. Some people who knew someone that we knew. Some people that shared a bus with someone that we knew once. Happily, everyone was happy to help. And we also managed to persuade the companies that we'd interviewed so diligently with to become clients of our business. And pretty soon we were off and running. So what did this teach me? Well, first, if you consult widely and learn how to ask good questions, it can get you a long way. The management guru, Peter Drucker, puts it rather more succinctly. He says, the leader of the past knows how to tell. The leader of the future knows how to ask. And particularly now, there's so much information out there, the key is not knowing it, but knowing how to access it. And people often talk about entrepreneurship as going it alone or setting out on your own. But actually, it's the antithesis of that. It's about creating a network of people that you can reach out to, from employees, customers, suppliers, cheerleaders, anyone that you can involve in your network. And that, so that question, if not you, who, isn't always a rhetorical one. Work out what you don't know, and then find someone who does. So, destitution. Okay, maybe destitution's a bit melodramatic. But if you're a student, you've already got a mountain of debt. And the older you get, the more financial responsibilities you have, or you tend to accumulate. A mortgage, car, children, money pit, expensive tastes in handbags, perhaps all of the above. In either case, the idea of turning down a guaranteed income that will service your debts and ploughing everything into a startup with a totally uncertain financial future does seem insanely risky on the face of it. But there are two important mitigating factors here. For younger people, post-graduation is actually a fantastic time to start a business, precisely because you don't have those financial responsibilities already. And as recently ex-students, we were already used to living in semi-squalor. My own feeling was that I might never be in a better position to take a risk than I was when I was 21. And even if you're not in that boat, it's also true that you need far less money today to start a business, which makes it a much less risky than it once was. And I'm going to come back to that later. If not now, when? Procrastination. I've got loads of time. People always assume there's no rush. And even if you do want to start a business, they figure they've got plenty of time to do it. And there's always a reason to put off doing something difficult. And without wishing to put a downer on proceedings, it's impossible at this juncture for me not to talk about Kate Gross. Some of you may have read about her in the last few months. Kate and I were in the same year at Oxford. And although sadly I didn't know her personally, we had some mutual friends. And I think her link to her made her story, for me, even more affecting than it would have been anyway. For those of you not familiar, Kate left Oxford and went on to have a really high-flying career in the civil service. She worked for Tony Blair and Gordon Brown in Downing Street, and then founded Blair's new charitable initiative around governance in Africa. And then she was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer. And she died on Christmas Day, this last Christmas Day, 10 minutes before her 5-year-old twin boys woke up. And she was 36, same age I am now. And I think it's really hard to try and draw any meaning from that incredibly sad story without just sounding incredibly trite. But But in those 2 years since diagnosis, she wrote a book, and if you haven't seen it, I really recommend it. She's just been published posthumously. It's called Late Fragments. And actually, it's tremendously uplifting and tremendously powerful. And I couldn't read it without just thinking about how much time we take for granted, you know, and we just forget to make the most of it and forget to enjoy it. And I know when I graduated, I felt I had all sorts of time forever to do whatever I wanted, just stretched out leisurely in front of me. But suddenly you turn around and it's 15 years later. And if you're really unlucky, you might not have that much time. But the message really is, why put off till tomorrow what you can do today? I mean, the only moment you can really be certain of is now. In other words, if not now, when? I think the other big thing that holds us back from taking risks and trying something different, and it doesn't really get talked about all that much really, is our kind of need to fit in, you know, stick to the well-trodden path. And actually for me, that was the hardest thing in retrospect to overcome. We've talked already about how society teaches gender roles, but it's much broader than that. It's about normalisation more generally. And my brother pointed me recently in the direction of a great video, if you haven't seen it, made by the Jubilee Project. And it asked 50 people just one question. What would you change about your body? Now, I'll give you a second to think what your own answer to that might be. Okay, what would you change about your body? I hope everyone's got an answer in their minds. Perhaps, like some of the people in the video, you'd have gone for something like my height, my big ears, my stretch marks. It's not me, honestly. But the interesting thing about this project was that they also asked a group of children the same question. And here's a sample of their answers. I want to have a mermaid tail. I want a shark's mouth so I can eat loads of food. I want wings so I can fly. Isn't it brilliant how children chose to add superpowers and most of the adults choose to fix perceived flaws? And I think what this tells us over time is that we conform. You know, our minds close, our worldview contracts and it's shaped and moulded by what's around us. And the more time goes by, the harder it is to escape those shackles. And of course, fitting in is important. It's comfortable, it's necessary. Ask any teenager ever. But later in life, it can also become a major barrier to ambition, to innovation, to creative thinking. So back in 2000, when I had my own decision to make, I kept coming back to the same conclusion. If I was going to do it, I should do it now. And if not now, when? And ultimately, for all the brilliant people I met at Oxford, arguably my best advice came from an academic of a different sort. Well, he claims to have a PhD. And while relying on the wisdom of soft drink manufacturers, that might sound like a bad idea, and it definitely would have been if I'd gone with this one. What's the worst that can happen is actually pretty good advice, at least in my position. Because being an entrepreneur is not just about taking risk, it's about managing risk, thinking through the consequences and really managing the downside. So he knows his stuff, the good doctor. Now, I talked already about how 2000 was a brilliant time to start a business, because loads of different people were doing it and there was a real culture of it. And of course, in retrospect, this period wasn't quite so revolutionary after all, because the massive dot-com boom was quickly followed by the massive dot-com bust, and the UK went back to its old cynical self again. But when I look at the landscape again today, it again feels like a brilliant time to start a business, and this time for much more sustainable reasons. This picture from Christmas reminds me how much has changed in the last century for my own family. This is me, my husband, and my children, and my grandparents. And my baby son, Harry, and my grandfather, Ogunga, were born almost exactly 95 years apart, from the steppes of Mongolia to the Surrey Hills, in less than a century. And as my grandparents showed, it's possible to move continents, of course, in the early 1920s. But the massive increase in global mobility that we're seeing today has made it easier than ever before to draw talent, inspiration, and ideas from every corner of the world. And we're seeing this kind of radical transformation in all sorts of other areas, and it's having an absolutely massive impact in business today. Technology now, more than ever, is disrupting the business landscape. It's cheaper and faster than ever to reach consumers, to reach new markets. And the costs of manufacturing, traditional large-scale fixed costs, like manufacturing, production, distribution, they're coming down all the time. In fact, they're trending towards zero, and they're increasingly variable costs. So these days, you can create a prototype on a 3D printer, crowdfund your business online, and have a finished product manufactured, shipped from halfway around the world to your desk in a matter of weeks. And this ease of access to consumers, to capital, to knowledge, to talent, is driving the rise of the so-called unicorn. Have you heard this term? The unicorn, that's a billion-dollar startup company. It comes from nowhere and competes with the traditional models in seemingly no time at all. The businesses like Facebook, like Uber, like Airbnb. And this rapid transformation of the business landscape, sudden emergence of new competitors, disruptive impact of new technology, it means that today, perhaps more than ever, success today is no determinant of success tomorrow. And actually, if you look at the study of the Fortune 1000, an entrance to the Fortune 1000, about 30% of businesses between 1960 and 1970 were new to the Fortune 1000 for the first time. Looking back at the past decade, almost 70% of businesses in the 1,000 biggest companies of the world are new. So we're seeing this massive disruption, this huge changeover. So how do we respond to this? I think maybe the answer lies in the Agile movement. Now, this is a manifesto that's currently being embraced by lots of organisations around the world, and particularly entrepreneurial firms. And rather than the traditional, well-structured, consider, plan, act approach to business, this is very much now, so kind of ready, aim, fire. Instead, businesses are optimising for agility. So they're trying to cultivate nimbleness, the ability to change direction quickly and efficiently, and to respond to the market changes very quickly. It's much more like ready, fire, aim. And for me, I think the basis of the Agile movement, this constant learning through feedback, kind of rapid cycles of iteration, constantly refining your approach, it certainly seemed to make perfect sense and very much appealed to the engineer in me. And I'm sure that's the answer, actually, in business, and perhaps also in life too. But there's also another reason why this year's St. John's graduates have a great opportunity to make their mark, if they have entrepreneurial, you know, desires. And they live in one of the best places in the world to start a business. Now, clearly I'm a bit biased here, because part of my job as a business ambassador is to go around telling people what a great place the UK is to do business. But I genuinely believe that this country, at this moment, is a brilliant place to start and grow a global business. Now, why? Fundamentally, we have world-class higher education establishments like this, which creates amazing access to talent, a hugely strong science base, and very strong creative talent, which can turn that from theory to application. And then there's all the supporting infrastructure, things that we probably just take for granted. A strong legal system, the ability to create IP and enforce it, access to capital. And now also, it's incredibly cheap to start a business and simple to start a business here. It takes £15 and you can register online and be up and running in a matter of days. So if not now, when? And if not here, where? So earlier this week, it occurred to me, not before time, you might say, to find out a bit more about Lady White, who we've spoken about briefly this evening already, and in whose honour we're all here today. And if you didn't know her story, Lady White married Thomas White in 1558, shortly after he founded the college. But before the marriage, he drew up a bond, a modern-day prenup, perhaps, and promised her land that would give her an income after his death. However, unfortunately, Sir Thomas died before the land was allocated. And under the terms of the bond, Lady White was entitled to a lump sum of £4,000 from his estate. The bad news for St John's, they'd been supposed to get most of this. And without the money, the fledgling college would have been in danger of going bankrupt. Now, Lady White could easily have taken the money and walked away, and perhaps other women in her situation might well have done. But instead, she chose to give it back to the college, who used the money to buy the property that has secured its future prosperity. And to me, that shows a woman who was confident in herself and was clearly a pretty good judge of entrepreneurial risk. So how do we sum all this up? I've tried to give you a sense of how my time in Oxford shaped my self-image and my attitude to risk and the opportunities that it opened up for me. And I've tried to give you a sense of why I think there's an amazing opportunity for people today to make their mark in the world. But if I had to sum it up in five things I wish I'd known when I arrived here in 1996, or perhaps five things I'll tell my daughter in the same situation, I'd say, firstly, when you're trying to find your own path, don't be afraid to explore new avenues, even if you don't know where they might go, and even if some turn out to be dead ends. Second, be an optimist. Take risks. Expect them to pay off. As Henry Ford said, whether you think you can or whether you think you can't, you're probably right. Third, there is no normal. Don't measure yourself against anybody else's definition of success. It's only the definition that you choose for yourself is the one that matters. This man again. I told you before that I asked Richard Branson for advice when I met him that night in the Petit Blanc, whether to take the corporate job or to set out on my own as an entrepreneur. What I didn't tell you is that the great Richard Branson, one of the UK's great entrepreneurs, told me to go and take the job at McKinsey. So the fourth thing, ask for advice, but don't always listen to it. Take responsibility, trust your judgment, and make your own choices. Because the American writer Clementine Paddleford wrote, "Never grow a wishbone, daughter, where your backbone ought to be." And if you ever find yourself burdened by self-doubt, just keep telling yourself this: if not you, who? And if not now, when? Thank you.